When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
We play an ugly game.
I want winners. I want people that want to win.
When you play the Game of Thrones, you win, you die. There is no middle ground.
You play to win the game. Hello? You play to win the game.
Welcome back to House of the Dragon 2 Electric Boogaloo. I'm yours, Anthony. This week we are re-airing an episode of Double Dragon. This is The Rogue Prince, Season 1, Episode 2 of House of the Dragon.
Steve, this king just loves his train set. Just really into this train set.
Thank God for model Westeros.
Do you think when they invent trains, he's going to like it more or less?
Oh, well, that's the question, right? Did trains replace the dragons?
Yeah, well, the dragons go into decline, they add trains.
Yeah.
It seems to me like if you add trains to that train set, it would actually improve it.
Well, right now it doesn't do anything, right? I mean, it's not like it's a Rube Goldberg
and
device.
He's so into it. He's just so excited about it.
I think this is like that might be one of the more underrated parts of, like, you're trying to figure out is he inept? Is he, you know, is he okay? Like, there's just moment, like I think, I mean, I
it's okay to have a hobby.
I appreciate Otto sending his daughter in to check on him, but like, I think he needs to have like round the clock people checking on him.
He's got a teenager coming in to watch him play with a train set without any trains.
Oh no, I dropped my dragon. Just throws himself on the couch.
All right, Steve, I have identified 5 storylines, and I just thought we'd do them all. Just cover all of the storylines. What do you think?
So you're saying what we should do is, in this review of the television show, review the television show in its entirety.
It's a new thing for us, but I think we should try it at least once.
All right. Well, the good news is I was awake through the whole episode,
Ooh.
So I feel like I have a really good shot at contributing
nice work.
To this. And even an even higher level than last time.
Way to go, Granddad.
However, I did just watch it like an hour ago.
You didn't watch it last night?
No, I was running Punchline.
Oh, of course. You got that Sunday conflict.
Well, but the Punchline thing is kind of like my Game of Thrones.
Right.
Because, you know, I mean, I'm the one who decides who goes up and who doesn't.
Well, you're King Viserys. It's sort of like you're a little bit passive. Sometimes you're a little too passive, right? Did you go up yourself? Did you put yourself up?
I did not put myself
up. See, this is the problem. You're sitting in the corner with your broken dragon figurine. You're not seizing the power when it's there to be seized.
But here's the thing, is no matter what, I walk around that room and it's just like everybody bends the knee like they're doing the opposite wave.
That's what they do, and yet they're getting the stage time. See, this is what I'm talking about.
See, that's the thing, is I give them the crumbs.
Mm-hmm. This is how you view it. Everyone's talking behind your back saying, this guy thinks he's in charge, he's getting no stage time.
Everybody wants me out of the way, but at the same time, it's like someone's got to sit there.
All right, so
heavy is the head that wears the blonde wig.
I've got five storylines here. The first one is the king's marriage. So King Viserys is getting pressure from all sides to remarry. His relationship with Alicent seems to have come to a more intimate, albeit platonic, stage. Viserys seems to consider marrying a 12-year-old Lena? Lena Valerian. Everyone who speaks up seems to think that this is the best course of action. The king decides against it and announces his marriage to Alicent. All except Otto are unhappy by the choice. Steve, are you getting enough maggots in your life?
I'm glad you brought that up. So when's the last time you came into contact with maggots?
I feel like I ate a piece of moldy salami the other day.
Oh.
I basically gagged for the next 14 hours. I couldn't get the taste out of my mouth. I don't know the last time I touched a maggot.
I don't know the last time I touched a maggot. I know there were maggots underneath my house because one of our pipes, the garbage disposal pipe specifically, had like corroded, and so it was just dumping
pipe maggots.
So it was just dumping stuff under the house, and then that seemed to attract maggots. Funny how that works.
They're not. They really aren't that menacing. I mean, you look at them, you just think that. I mean, they shouldn't scare or gross out anyone, but they just... Yeah,
they're not jumping maggots, right? I mean, it'd be something if... Oh, yeah, those are the screaming maggots. I mean, they're just wriggling.
Why are they so gross? I mean, I don't get grossed out by a worm. If I see a worm, it's fine. It's like, yeah, it's just a worm. But, I mean, is a maggot all that different than a worm?
It's funny, because a maggot's going to turn into a fly, right?
Yes.
And then the fly is going to bug you, like bother you.
Sure. Right?
Like, I mean, I'm a little grossed out.
Yeah, it's a little gross. Flies are a little gross.
I mean, it's a little gross when you see them on the potato salad, because that just seems to be where I always seem to find them. And so I don't like it. I don't like the way that they, you know, like they rub their hands when they look at you. Like, that's pretty menacing. And
like they're hatching a plan.
Yeah, exactly. And like, and in such a way that it's like they want you to know they are. I mean, that's like the insect equivalent of like twirling their own mustache.
right, of course.
But and the thing is, a maggot is like the least menacing fly, right? It's not, I mean, they don't even seem, they almost look more like an optical illusion, right? Like they just sort of wriggle amongst themselves. If anything, if I was a maggot, I'd be more grossed out by maggots because I know I'm going to be amongst more maggots and they're going to be all over me.
Yeah, famously, this is probably the scariest scene from The Lost Boys, right?
It
wasn't the vampires, it was the maggots.
Right, well, he was eating them. That was a part of it, right?
I mean, yeah, but was that the illusion or not?
I don't know.
See, I never was clear on that point.
Funny thing, yeah, I mean, even though we're discussing it now, I don't think I'm going to convince myself that maggots are fine.
Yeah, they're gross. I don't know why they're so gross. They're just totally gross.
Yeah, they're like amongst the worst.
They're amongst the worst. Man, we are 10 minutes into this podcast. We've covered nothing. Train sets and maggots.
You said you wanted to cover all the storylines, and we're out of time, kids. Tune in next week.
I just want to cover the most irrelevant elements of every storyline.
But the thing is they're, but yeah, I don't know. I mean, they're irrelevant, but they're not. I mean, they were very captivated, right? I mean, obviously, we're trying to. The maggot scene brings you to a certain time.
Like, what is it about this guy that every single time he gets cut, he's got to cut off his body part or something? Like,
I know the whole time, just like, so this is, I've got like a wonderful little nickname for him here is King Scabby Patty. it's just so simple where it's like everyone gets together. It's like, all right, let's dip his finger in maggots. Man, is this the most high maintenance.
Just stick him in the room with the train set, man. Just stick him in there.
But that's where he's cutting himself.
So, all right, let's talk about the King's marriage. It was 6 months, out from this initial, I guess, C-section. That's the other thing. This episode had zero C-sections.
Yeah, finally. That's right. So 6 months out, but you got to figure this is in, like, what, Westeros years, right? So I don't know what the lifespan is of a person. So 6 months is probably, like, closer to, like, a year and a half, yeah, I would think, given the fact that even the king has to dip his hand in maggots just to keep a finger. This is a wonderful would you rather. Would you rather lose a finger or have to soak in palm olive made of maggots?
So he's been staring at his empty train set for almost a year and a half by Westerosi standards, right?
According to my conversion scale.
And he's getting pressured to remarry, which, you know, he's the king. You know, he's got an heir, but clearly people aren't happy with the heir he chose, right? And so the suggestion is that he is going to marry a 12-year-old who looks like an 8-year-old.
So again, playing a different game of would you rather.
They had to find a wife young enough to enjoy a train set without trains.
I love the idea that she's just marrying him for the dollhouse.
I'll tell you what, man. It takes a lot to gross me out. I mean, it takes a, especially with
Game of Thrones. When maggots is like maybe third.
It's like Game of Thrones has, you know, torture and incest and all this stuff. But I tell you what, him walking through the garden, just talking with that little girl, and everyone's watching.
It would be a great honor to join our houses as they were in old Valyria. I would give you many children of pure Valyrian blood so that we might strengthen the royal line and the realm.
Is that what your father told you to say? What did your mother tell you?
That I wouldn't have to bed you until I turn 14.
That was one of the grossest things I saw.
Super cringy.
Horrible. And, you know, it's not even like, it's, you know, that he's uncomfortable with it. It's like everyone feels like this is really kind of gross, but it's the king. And so everyone's kind of
so that was and that was an interesting way to take this, right? Because we've already, you know, even leading up to this in other podcasts, we talked about how, like, hey, from what we know of, you know, the Targaryen history, we're going to have to, you know, buckle up, because there's certain things that are just sort of like, that's just their lifestyle. But it was interesting how the choice was made from the writers to still draw some level of squeamishness.
Oh, absolutely.
Across the board, like within the universe, right? So it wasn't
just I was thinking, find a sister to marry. Find a long lost sister. This is that would be better than this.
Right. So I did appreciate that. I mean, they could have gone the other way. I mean, they could have just been like, hey, this is just the way it goes, and been very matter of fact about it. I mean, I think that tells a different story. And I think, just to be perfectly honest, I think that's a story that many people would recoil from. I think from a presentation standpoint, you have to have some sort of a moral compass with regards to this approach. Otherwise, you can't have a cavalier attitude towards this across the board.
I think that seemingly the whole scene was very innocent. It's like, it's the king. It's in public. They're walking through the garden. He's clearly, by the end of the walk, he's clearly decided not to marry the girl, right?
Nothing quite as innocent as a 12-year-old telling an older king that, that they don't have to bed for another 2 years.
Yeah. And then, but even so, it's like everything, you know, nothing's consummated. There's no, but the whole thing just feels really wrong.
Well, that whole scene was essentially maggots. Yeah, sure. By itself, if you just really break it down, yeah, it's like, look, sure, like you said, just walking. They're just wriggling. But we know what that would become, and what that function is. And so it's really,
I think the thing that made it the grossest is that everyone, and I mean everyone, is telling the king that this is the best course of action.
Right? And it's amazing, like, how some was like all the different motivations for it, right? You know, some folks are just like, they're like, hey, we broke it down. You know, we we brought in the AI, mm-hmm. and we went through every possible scenario. And really, this is the best possible course of action right now.
Even so much so that we're all fine with him marrying a teenager afterwards.
Right.
You know, it's like, oh, gosh, at least she's a teenager.
What a relief. Yeah. No, I mean, I don't know that I was like, whew.
but, no, but at least it didn't, it wasn't like.
Yeah.
I mean, at least that girl just looked like she's 8 years old, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Right. And yeah, and so, yeah, sure. So sure, it is. There's a bit of relief by comparison, right? Again, playing the would you rather.
Mm-hmm.
And there's, but this whole thing is rife. I mean, I think that we, you know, we're talking about some of our own views on it, but I think it's worth really digging in and how, to me, this was such a compelling, thread, because of all the different players and how everybody's playing this king.
Everybody. Well, I was going to say that it's one of these things where as a king, there's a right course of action. And as a human, it's the exact wrong course of action.
Sure.
I think it's actually kind of a hard thing to do to portray adversaries who are kind of smart on both sides and authentic. Like, they've come by their decisions honestly on both sides.
Mm-hmm.
And you really see that, like, the king is about to make a horrible political choice, and it's absolutely the choice I would have made.
Sure.
Because the only thing I share in common with this guy is my humanity. And everything right, about okay. sort of me being human thinks that's wrong, you know?
But it's interesting, too, like, the so you have Otto Hightower, who's, you know, the hand of the king, so supposed to have this best interest in mind. But this is not in terms of advising the king, right?
Oh, this is a bad political move to put his daughter in the room for sure.
Right, and but this is all part of like this was a plan,
uh-huh.
right? So this really shows. I mean, I think we knew in episode one that Otto Hightower was very clever, and
almost a little Tywin Lannister vibe coming off this guy.
I would, yeah. Even looks and everything, sort of, it's kind of there. So as he puts this, as he sets this in motion, a real hand of the king, whose responsibility is not only to support him as a person, but ultimately you're supposed to be supporting him as, you know, as the king, as mm-hmm. in this role to keep his position and his line intact. And this would be the opposite. He would advise against it. The way he played the king in terms of like when he was asking his opinion, like, oh yeah, no, this mm-hmm. this really does make a lot of sense. So, but then he plays his own hand, like, well, you know, I know for me, the idea of after my wife passed, marrying out of compulsion or obligation just didn't set. Like he knows.
Yeah, he says the exact. He doesn't say like you shouldn't marry her,
mm-hmm.
but he says just enough to kind of plant the idea in the king's mind that, like...
Well, because he knows enough about the king and his motivations.
Right.
And so he knows which buttons to push, which is fascinating, too, because the king does not have... The king thinks he has agency, but he clearly has not.
Well, that reminded me of that line from Daemon Targaryen in the previous episode. He's like, I would protect you if I was hand of the king.
Right.
And he's like, protect me from what? And he says, I would protect you from yourself. And right. I was thinking, that's what Otto Hightower refuses to do. He's just going to allow the king to, like, make these human choices that Daemon Targaryen would absolutely advise against. I guess. That's how I'm reading that.
But beyond that, it's not that Otto Hightower is either too close to the king, so he's allowing for it, or he's yielding to the king's more internal instincts. It's the Otto Hightower has an agenda here, and it's working. So he's not. He'll protect him in so much as it helps Otto Hightower as well.
Oh sure, no, he's absolutely.
Which I think is a great reveal in this episode, because I think we get you know, it's so easy to say, well, Daemon Targaryen is the baddie, and that's what Game of Thrones does so well anyway, is like, you know, who do you trust and who's who's bad? Are they all bad? Or is it all...
Bad guys will act nobly, and good guys will make mistakes and do horrible things, right?
Yeah, and who's more sinister? The one that sits on the throne blatantly and challenges the king at every turn out in the open? Or the one that sits at his side and says that he has his best interest in mind?
Well, that's the other thing. I feel like Daemon's not a great political mind. I think we saw that in this episode.
Right. Yeah.
So I don't think the solution is for him to be Hand of the King, but clearly Otto Hightower is putting his own political advancement above the king in the realm.
Right.
So he's the exact wrong Hand of the King.
Yeah. Oh, for sure. But he's in the best position possible, right, to be able to enact a plan.
Again, shades then, of Tywin, right?
Right. And then you've got, you know, and then meanwhile you have the Corlys.
Good. It's all right. Storyline number two. We'll just jump right in here. This is the Sea Snake storyline. Lord Corlys Velaryon is pissed off that more isn't being done about Kragas Dahar.
Mm-hmm.
Seems that the crab feeder has attacked a Velaryon ship. Later, the Sea Snake apologizes and proposes a marriage between the king and his 12-year-old daughter. Corlys is offended when the king refuses and seeks an alliance with Daemon. According to Lord Corlys, Daemon can prove his worth by taking down the crab feeder. All right, so what you were going to say.
Man, again, talk about the way that they all know how to... They all know how to appeal to and play Viserys, because, you know, Corlys comes in hot. He wants action. He wants the king to make a decision to send a message and all this stuff. And then later, when he goes to make his proposal, I mean, deferential, apologetic, and the king doesn't, you know, previous kings that we've seen in these universes would have just been like, too little too late, you're off the council kind of thing. Nobody comes in here and shows me. Like, it could have been a variety of, but he's just so like, he appeals to his mercy, right?
His cousin says in another part of the episode, she says, and your father is no fool, right?
Right.
And I think that's kind of true. I don't think he is a fool. I actually think that he's got a kind of wisdom that would make him really valuable as some other office in the kingdom. But I think that he absolutely suffers fools.
Well, that's the thing. There's a lot about him that you would say, that's the kind of king you might want. But right. You do need to have a good council that has not just the king's best interest in mind, but the realm's best interest. And that's how they operate, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where the king would be the one to say, okay, but what about, like, he could bring up, like, a moral discussion or whatever. But, like, when he comes down to it, I'm like, he's constantly asking, like, again, you want to seek counsel. But then there comes a point where it's like, at some point, the king does need, the buck stops with you. And so we see that when he chooses Alicent. But it's still, you know, and the irony of that whole thing is like, he did something to show that he had agency and he kind of bucked all the advice. It's like, but he didn't, right? I mean, ultimately, he still did. He kind of lured into Hightower's.
He thought it was his own choice, right? It was really was what Otto wanted. I was thinking about contrasting this episode with the choice he makes last episode.
Mm.
I think that the maesters and everyone in the kingdom would say, oh, no, you absolutely have to choose the heir. You've got a chance for a male heir here. Sorry about your wife, but she's got to go. You've got to make the choice for the baby. I think he does make that choice in support of the kingdom. At least that's what he thinks he's doing.
Right.
And in this episode, it's like, I tried it. I tried doing that. I'm going to choose what I think is right based on sort of my own sense of morality here. I'm going to choose the woman who I have some kind of relationship with who isn't 7 years old, you know?
And like, given the idea that, like, look, he says, you know, I loved your mother. And you have another, you see the juxtaposition when Daemon talks about his wife and why he wants to take a second wife and whether or not you trust Daemon at this point.
Uh-huh.
But I think that there is some truth to what he was saying. He's like, I didn't choose her. I didn't choose my wife.
Right.
And so there is, so it's a nice way that the writers can add, like, this is, I think, what we talked about before about, like, trusting your audience and some of the issues that we may have had with the first episode in terms of, like, see, connected to this, connected to that. Like, it may be a little bit too on the nose, whereas this, there's these nice little subtle things that remind you that, like, there's a difference. If he, to say that he loved his wife, after the fact especially, I mean, granted, he's talking to his daughter, but I believe him. You know, there was a uniqueness to that relationship. And if he's going to marry again, and he said, look, it's only been 6 months. If he was truly mission-minded and understood lineage and preserving the name, he would kind of suck it up a little bit and be like, all right, it's time to get married. Look, this is duty. But for him, marriage wasn't just duty. Whereas, and we see that, like I said, the juxtaposition with Damon's reference to, like, I didn't choose my wife, shows that that's the culture. Mm-hmm. So he's already bucking the culture. So it does make sense that he would choose Alicent again. You know, hey, maybe give it another 6 months and see what happens. Get out there, you know, get on whatever app Westeros has for this type of thing.
Right. Well, I should say,
I just keep on connecting with Dornish women, and that's just not my type.
I should say, I mean, it's an obvious point, but it should be made. We saw a lot of marriages in the first series. No marriage that was ever sort of for love ever ends well, right?
True, true.
Right? So you've got Rob, you know, he decides to marry for love and the red wedding happens.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Tyrion decides to marry the crofter's daughter and, you know, no marriage based on love. And then, of course, Jon and Dany at the end, you know. It's just in this world, in Martin's world, if you don't use marriage for a political purpose, you're foolish. Something mm-hmm. horrible is going to happen. And I think that that's what's going. I think that that's what this story is trying to tell.
Well, just by virtue of what it's going to set in motion, right? Like, I mean, as cringy as it was in the world that's been laid out in front of us, the idea that that you could unify the houses to get, and again, that assumes that that's the end of that story. But clearly, once Corlys' reaction shows that, like, kind of called the bluff. In some ways, right?
Yeah.
Corlys was not looking for the greater good. He's looking for another way to keep the door open
interesting character for me because he has all of the pride of an old house, right?
Mm-hmm.
And if it was just for that one little thing, that one little detail of dragons, right? If it wasn't for that one little detail of dragons, he... Yeah, the world would be his oyster, right? So
right.
It's kind of interesting to see him try to outmaneuver all of these dragon riders who, I mean, I guess, you know, you get Daemon Targaryen with no dragon. I guess he's still a pretty good swordsman or whatever, but it's like he's nowhere near the force.
You don't, like I said, we don't bring a sword to a dragon fight.
That's right. So this bit at the end, I wanted to ask about this bit at the end. I think that the story they're trying to tell is Daemon's not the best political mind, but if you give him Corlys on his team, then all of a sudden he has this new superpower. Because Corlys is not just a man of action. He's also got a political mind as well.
Mm-hmm.
And so maybe that kind of tempers some of those impulses that Daemon otherwise has.
Right. And the advantage of having Daemon, obviously, is you've got, you have a bit of an army.
Well, you got a big old dragon now. Like, that's the one thing that Corlys could never get.
And you do have at least the appearance of an heir. There's an heir of an heir to him, right? So that helps that it, you know, again, that's a politically, it's an optics thing from a political perspective that is positive, that is helpful. Corlys, like you said, with a plan, he had a plan and Viserys sort of usurped it, whether or not it was because he was clever or just because he was impetuous or who knows, right? I mean, it's trying to figure out what, because I think Viserys is really worth examining because and this is a character that I didn't know that I was going to be as interested in as I mean, again, we're only two episodes in, but
right.
The nuance of like, is he too good for his own good? Is he, you know, what is it, right? I mean, because kings oftentimes, you know, like, yeah, they have their councils, but they also have their egos, and his ego may be baked into his humility. And that might be an even more problematic issue.
It's interesting. Do you have a sense or a visceral reaction to the crab feeder guy?
I'm cautiously optimistic. There's a part of me that's like, this feels like a Street Fighter villain, like it's Vega, or it's the Phantom of the Ocean. Medieval Leatherface.
Phantom of the Ocean is the winner today. Absolutely. He's the Phantom of the Ocean. I'm going to say this again, and maybe I'll say this every episode, but I do miss the... It's sort of a show devoid of warmth or levity.
Oh, okay.
And again, I was like, you can bring in someone like Corliss... And have him, you know, give him a little bit more personality. How about a joke or two? How about a character that isn't Machiavellian? I don't know. I keep thinking back to, like, you know, when John meets Ygritte, how much we love that, or, you know, Arya and the Hound on the road, or, you know.
So in the first two episodes of Game of Thrones, again, refresh my memory, we got some levity, right? Or at least we got to see, like, the kids.
We had at least four or five one-liners from Tyrion, right?
Oh, yeah. So we got
Tyrion. We had Bran climbing trees. We had, you know, Jon giving Arya a needle for the first time. This is all kind of like, I know who to root for in a show like that. So...
I think there was supposed to be some degree of levity with the choosing of the guard.
I want to talk about that. I want to talk about this. All right. This first guard that they are interviewing,
mm-hmm.
dude, like, this is the first rule of interviewing. You gotta say something. Like, you don't have to talk a lot. You don't wanna over talk. But I feel like saying something would be advantageous.
Just like he went to, like, whatever his whatever website he went to for how to nail your interview, right? He's like, if you're concerned, if you're nervous, just stand strong.
Just stare him down. Just stare him down, and they'll give you the job. I mean, he dressed the part. I mean, he really dressed up for this interview.
Right, so. Got dressed up. He was on time, obviously. But when it came right, because what they say a lot of times is this: if you don't have, like, a really good example, it's okay to say, "Can I come back to this question? I just need to think on this for a little while." Like, that's the way to do it. But
or you could just stand there,
stare at him, yeah,
without saying a word.
Yeah, that's the second best option.
I feel like he went home to his wife, and he was like, "She's, did you get the job?" He's like, "No."
Once again, I lost out to somebody who's a little chattier than me. Honey, I've told you, you have. Did you get asked a question?
Maybe.
Did you get asked a question? Well, yeah, but did you answer it? Honey, you didn't answer again, didn't you?
Oh, this guy. And I'm just thinking, like, maybe he wanted to answer, but it's sort of like, look, we spent all the money on the dragons. You got no lines.
Yeah, they're, again, one of the things are like, look, HBO's like, things didn't go great with the end of Game of Thrones, so we're gonna give you great effects budgets, we're gonna give you wonderful costuming budget, but we're gonna give you way more extras. I wanna go all over. Like, no, we're gonna focus in on one family. And most of the knights are just background.
Here's the rule. If you bring in a guy in bright yellow, he's a little bit jowly. No lines. No lines.
That's right. You can't have yellow and jowls and lines.
All right. So Kristen gets the job and he's allowed to talk. I think that that's a great benefit.
Yeah. Huge benefit.
For easy almost any eyes. Job. So... Oh, the other part of it that I thought was interesting was, so Otto wants to use this appointment for political ends. He's like, I can I can make a lord happy if I choose the lord's oldest son or something like that. Rhaenyra's thinking more practically. She's like, can he fight? I want to know if he can fight. And so she chooses a guy who can fight, and Otto's sort of second guessing her.
Right.
But then when it comes time to go confront Daemon at Dragonstone, who does he take with him?
Right, right.
He takes with him the guy that he knows would defeated Daemon in the tourney. So it's sort of this validation for Rhaenyra's choice in the end.
Is it? I mean, that's a good question, though. I think on the surface, that's what I would take it as. Like, hey, well, like, is it a, well, this is who I've got because he was assigned? Or is it also like, I know this will also goad Daemon.
Oh, interesting.
To make a foolish move. Because if you know that Daemon is, as we talked about in the previous podcast, if he's vulnerable, if he's insecure, it makes him a little more volatile, right? Which means that any plan he may have had might be thwarted. And I think we see that. I think we see what happens is that he comes in with a plan and it got thwarted pretty easy.
Right.
And because he didn't even consult with his woman. to even tell her what the plan was. So she's looking at him like,
oh, I'm pregnant now? Is that the story you've been telling? You've been telling people I'm pregnant, huh?
So this is the whole thing. This was your whole egg plan? So I think, there was so much revealed in that. And so when you think about Hightower's political motivations, but he makes sure that the king stays behind. Uh-huh. He says he does that because he wants to go, because the king is too valuable. And it's like, when you asked last week, do you feel like you're watching Game of Thrones? This week I did.
Right.
Because of that, because anytime that, like, so now that Hightower is there to protect the king, I still am like, is he, or is he trying to get to Daemon? And what is he trying to do there? Right. Like, is he just trying to stop Daemon? Like, what's his plan? He knows he's got a dragon.
Well, that, I was going to ask you that question. I was going to ask you, like, does Hightower want an excuse to kill Daemon? And if so, what does he think he's going to do about the dragon?
Yeah, so that part I wasn't quite sure, because you know that that's a reality. But I don't think, it didn't seem to me that he was really in there to battle them. Necessarily, but I don't know what the next thing would have been.
Well, like, you brought up the point, like, you, why bring Criston Cole,
right?
If you don't think that you're going to use that guy to provoke Daemon, and I feel like this is a guy either you're counting on him acting rashly, right?
Yeah, if Daemon does something, and now he's killed one of your guards. I mean, like, if you want to talk about. Because the term sedition came up, right?
Mm-hmm.
And if, clearly they got him for stealing this dragon egg. And then if he kills one of the guards, that seems like you got a lot. I mean, if you want to take this to more of a political end, it's hard to argue, right? I mean, now it's... Regardless of who he is and what his last name is... That there may be a bridge too far, right? So it seems
Dragonstone's
like there
a little
been.
Bit like Mar-a-Lago right now.
It's yeah, that was them with their warrant. And they got a redacted egg back.
Like, I'm the rightful heir, man. I'm the rightful heir. This is my egg.
This is my egg. It was my egg from the beginning.
I told him he could keep the train set, and I could have any egg. I just go ask him. Just ask him. I said,
that's why you didn't want him to come, because you knew he'd have been like, oh, that's right, the train set.
So this is my favorite scene of the episode, because
when Rhaenyra shows up,
because I think it could have gone wrong in any number of ways, but she kind of what card is she really playing? I don't think she's playing the dragon card. I think she's walking up to him and sort of daring him to do what he is threatening to do. And that is to, become the new heir. You think you're the real heir, all right? Here I am. What are you going to do about it?
I'm right here, Uncle. The object of your ire. The reason that you were disinherited. If you wish to be restored as heir, you'll need to kill me. So do it. And be done with all this bother.
And I think that the first episode really establishes that they have a relationship where they respect each other. And so when she stares him down like that, you kind of get the sense that he feels like, well, I think she's got checkmate here. I don't know what I'm going to do. I think I got to get back this egg.
That's the ultimate, because that's the whole thing. Like, think about it. She's like, okay, if this is your plan, and that's one thing if this plan had been, you know, 6 months ago or 7 months ago. Mm-hmm. But now I have been declared the heir.
Right.
So now you want my position. And the only way you are getting it is if I'm out of the picture. Right. And since you're willing to go this far, are you willing to take the next step? And the thing that was fascinating is that it happens out in public.
And she switches from Targaryen to the common tongue, right?
Yes, that was going to be my next point.
So she establishes the conversation. We are equals. We both speak High Valyrian. But then when she says, "Here I am, I'm the object of your ire, just strike me down," she says it for everyone to hear, right? It's the common tongue. So.
And so he gets backed into a corner, and he just goes to the egg toss. And I just, that scene is pretty wonderful.
It's great.
Because it does set up, it sets up a lot. And it does set up the ultimate, if we're only two episodes in, and that level of what we've seen, what we saw the relationship-wise in the first episode, coming to this point where it was like, all right, well, if we're going to do this, this is where it has to go. And we can do it right now if you want. It'll never be easier.
Right.
And it's interesting because you talk about, like, again, going back to his insecurity, maybe his vulnerability, he's not very strategic. I mean, he did not have an answer for that. He had nothing.
Okay, let me ask you a hypothetical here. Let's say the king does go to Dragonstone. Let's say Viserys is sort of up in his feelings and he gets on a ship and he goes out to Dragonstone. You're Daemon Targaryen. Do you kill the king? Do you kill your brother? Do you think he would have killed his brother?
I don't think he would have had to, because I think there would have been an opportunity for him to sort of play Viserys as well, and I think that might have been part of the other reason why Otto Hightower goes out there, is because the king can be swayed, and sure, he may be fired up, but we don't know, from a brother to brother perspective, how clever Daemon might be. Like, Daemon doesn't have to be, like, his plan, I think, was essentially to have the king show up. I think that's what he was setting up.
I think so too. And I think he might have killed him.
You think so?
Well, I'm thinking, like, let's say he wants his brother out of the way. I think he does still love his brother, but I think he might think this is the only way for there to be a strong king on the throne.
Well, if he kills his brother, then it sets into motion. Now Rhaenyra is in charge.
Yeah, I think, and if that happens, he just...
You think it's just a full coup?
Yeah, I think so. And I think that's what maybe he thought was going to happen. But when she shows up, I don't think he knows what to do.
Well, and I the only reason why I think that maybe he might not have... I don't know that he had a great plan, but I think he was setting up for... appealing to his brother's sensitivity, especially with regard to the whole plan about marrying for love.
Oh, interesting.
I think that would have been maybe the first move. Appeal to that notion, soften his brother up, get back in his good graces. Now you're not, at least you're not now maybe exiled in Dragonstone. It almost becomes like a negotiation that, And Otto Hightower knows that maybe the king may be susceptible to something like that. And so then that sets a different... Because you see later with Corlys, when Corlys is talking all kinds of trash against Viserys, Daemon stops him.
Yeah.
Like, I can do that. So there isn't... I mean, it's a classic, you know, hey, I can make fun of my family, but no one else can. So that to me, that was my indicator that maybe he wasn't quite ready for that yet. Like, there was still some degree of, like, look, I may hate my brother, but it's my brother. And
yeah, there was that sense. It's like you can, I can talk trash, but you can't.
Yeah, so I don't know. Certainly an argument could be made either way. But that was my reading was I don't know that I don't think that that was the plan because of the way that it was set up with such an emphasis on marriage and birthright, things like that. So that even though it was an insult to take Balin's egg, right?
Okay, we've already covered some of storyline 4 here. The court is up in arms at the news of a stolen dragon egg. Viserys learns that it was his brother. Rhaenyra asks which egg was taken. When the king finds out that Daemon took his son's egg, he wants to confront Daemon himself. Otto, however, talks him out of it. Otto takes 20 men to Dragonstone, where Daemon dares the hand of the king to take the egg from his hand. He allows his dragon to menace the king's men and seems intent on war. Rhaenyra swoops in and stares him down. Then Daemon is confronted by Massaria, who doesn't want children and doesn't want to live in fear. Later on, he seems to consider the Sea Snake's proposal to form an alliance. Massaria is clearly more than a paramour, right?
Right.
I mean, whatever their relationship is, she has some degree of power in this relationship.
Yeah, she has his ear, and it means something.
And it was interesting because I think that the first episode, you didn't get the like, she had power over him in that he allowed himself to be consoled by her, right?
Right.
But you heard a different kind of voice from her this episode. So I'm finding this relationship kind of interesting because it's pretty clear that Daemon has vulnerabilities. And one of them is that I think he's in love with her. I think he's in love with his paramour.
Right.
And yet he kind of lost this round, and now she's pissed off at him.
Yeah, which could only add to maybe some of that instability, right?
Sure.
If his avenue for solace and comfort becomes jeopardized, maybe even by his own decisions, it's like he's running out of places to turn because he gets further isolated, right?
Right. Right. And I think that she's interesting in that we kind of established last episode that how dangerous the birthing bed is.
Mm-hmm.
And she is intent to never have children. Like she's decided that I'm not going to live in fear. And it seems like this is a conversation they've had before. Like I'm not going to live that life.
Right.
This is storyline 3. This is called Rhaenyra Against the World. Rhaenyra continues to be belittled. Her suggestion to bring a show of force with dragons at the steps is met with dismissal. She's second-guessed by Otto in her choice for Kristen Cole. She isn't getting the whole story from Alicent. She's talked down to by Rhaenys, who seems to reinforce the order of things in Westeros. Then without consulting anyone, she flies Dreamfire to Dragonstone for a showdown with Daemon. She's confronted by her father, but wins him over pretty quickly. She learns of her father's new marriage to her best friend, along with everyone else, and leaves the room. So I think that this is kind of maybe the most important part of the episode, because it establishes that this girl who has been her best friend for years, I'm imagining, has kept this massive secret from her, and now her father is going to marry her best friend.
Yeah, her best friend becomes her stepmother.
Yeah, I just think that scene, they kept on sort of they hung on her face long enough to really get the sense that like she's feeling betrayed by this,
right? From every angle.
And yes, and I do get the sense that she knows, like, I don't think that my father's in the wrong. I gave him permission to remarry, and yet this is the worst possible thing that could have happened.
And another thing I think that's interesting is, like, I love the back and forth between her and Rhaenys, right? I mean, that sets a lot up for, I love the men would rather torch.
Put a torch, the realm to a torch or something like
that. Here is the hard truth, which no one else has the heart to tell you. Men would sooner put the realm to the torch than see a woman ascend the Iron Throne.
And she, you know, and she keeps bucking against it, like, no, they didn't reject a woman, they rejected you. Like, she's that, I'm a difference maker. It's different for me. It'll be different for me. And again, part of that is her ambition. Part of that is being probably 15. So all of that kind of comes crashing down, even though her father sort of took her advice, even though she had presented herself throughout this episode as making her own decisions for who's going to be, a Knight's Guard, and her reasoning was sound, and she made the call, and then she kind of saves the day with the with showing up at Dragonstone, and then she, you know, gives her
and her father has to kind of acknowledge it, like, you're probably right, it probably would have come to bloodshed if it was just Otto.
And then on top of that, you know, so then she gives him advice that he takes,
yeah,
but she didn't have all the information, right? And so when it's all said and done, when she sees that, it's like, well, this, you know, I've been lied to. I've been kind of kept out of the loop here. And some of those things that Rhaenys said echo. They have to, right? I mean, it's not just about the men in charge, but it's what women will do in power as well, or to preserve. Like, that was all part of that discussion, right? And so she's just got...
Well, Rhaenys is kind of the ultimate cynic at this point, right? Because I really do think that she was close enough to taste it.
Mm-hmm.
And now what's her nickname? The king, the queen who never was?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, she's lived a life. And she's lived in the patriarchy long enough so that I think that she kind of feels like, I really have to tell this girl the truth. She has to learn the way the world works at some point.
And there's a joy she gets in it too, right?
Yeah, like, there's, well, that other side of it. It's like,
you got the role that I want, and here's the thing. It's like, no, hey, I'm going to be a good auntie and tell you that you're screwed. And tell you all the reasons why you're wrong. Because ultimately what it comes down to is, I'm jealous of your position. But hey, I'm also giving you two things could be equally true here, right? I'm giving you real talk. And I'm doing it in a way that makes me feel good.
And I was getting a little bit of Dany vibes when she's like, well, when I'm queen, I will remake the order, right?
Right,
Change things when I'm queen, right?
Exactly, yeah, the idea of changing the order, right? That's great.
So I thought that was great. The fifth storyline we've already covered, this was the Kingsguard storyline. And so that leads us to Dismemberment Count, Steve.
Mm-hmm.
No dismemberments.
Pretty mild. In fact, we even saved a finger.
In fact, we're doing our best. We're doing our best to save the king's fingers. And then Cheek Speak Over Under. I think I got this one. I took the under.
Yeah, you got that one. Yeah, yeah. I don't even know if we saw Dragon Butthole, to be honest. I think it was actually...
I mean, even the crab feeder, his cheeks were actually covered.
Right.
So...
Okay, so we focused on the guy himself, but I mean, just crabs just going to eat people?
I think that they do.
Just a swarm of crabs.
That you
think so? You think they do that?
I think that
like alive.
Well, not alive. I don't know if they will alive, but I feel like I've seen carcasses on the beach and crabs kind of going for it.
I don't know, man. It was a little goofy. All the little clicking of the crabs. And it was, I mean, when I say it, I mean, it was effective, especially because it was pretty gory to watch some of the crabs going in and doing their thing. But I was just like, huh, crabs. I mean, I know I always figured crabs would be a problem in this universe, but.
All right, so then here's a question. Like, I look at those crabs and I'm thinking, like, I would eat a crab. I would definitely. But the question is, would I eat a crab that has been feeding on a human corpse?
Mm. And then it brought up the other questions, like, have I ever already eaten a crab?
I think I'm just going to say yes. I'm not going to quibble on these things. I just love crab. I love crab.
Yeah.
So I don't care if it's eaten a human corpse or not.
No, I think I'm with you. Yeah, I do. I do like me some crab. So you know, when we talk about when we did the rewatch, and you know, I was again, I was magic hesitant.
Yeah.
And then, you know, we got a smoke baby, and I'm kind of like, oh, you get a smoke baby, I feel like you can do whatever you want. And so I think the crab, I mean, while these weren't
famously,
necessarily magic
crabs. If you don't remember, we're talking about when Melisandre births the shadow demon from her womb. So you were not.
Yeah, but it was a shadow demon later, but it was born a smoke baby.
Okay, so yeah, all right, so you continue. You were thinking.
So, I, you know, even though I've accepted dragons, I had to remember, like, there's going to, you know, we're in a fantasy world, and if I could tolerate a smoke baby, I think I have to tolerate a a villain that has an army of crabs.
Well, I was thinking this episode, I was thinking, I miss the magic. Like, you remove the dragons, this is basically a political thriller, which is fine. You know, sure. That's always sort of been an element of Game of Thrones. And yet, I do feel like, as a fan of fantasy lit, I'm kind of waiting for the magic.
Again, I think you gotta just be on board with the fact that I don't know that he summons crabs, but I like to think that there may be a point where he gets all the crabs to come together to form like one giant crab, like the Constructicons. Mm-hmm. And and that giant crab will take on a dragon, like, and it's going to feel a lot like a
Mighty Morphin. That'd be Power great because you could punch through like a dragon could use its tail to like whip through the crab, but because it's just made up of tiny little crabs,
then they form all these little like maybe medium sized crabs, and they're just a Voltron of crabs.
That's what we want. We want a Voltron of crabs.
Well, I know they just renewed season two, so hopefully they're listening. Mm-hmm. I'd be remiss if I didn't ask the question. How do you feel about a title sequence?
Yeah, a little underwhelming. Glad to have the old Game of Thrones music back.
Okay, so that's another question. I mean, you're cool with just the same old music?
I think so. I feel like. I mean, honestly, most people are going to skip ahead anyway, right?
They shouldn't, because there's changes, right? I mean, I'm sure it's going to change like the other one did.
Why would it change? It's just blood and blood flowing. Like, they don't...
But it's flowing through different areas, right? I mean, it's... And different symbols are coming up.
Yeah.
So you were supposed to be the one who could walk me through that because of your extensive knowledge.
Yeah, I didn't quite get it. I'll be honest. I didn't quite get the whole blood through the channels thing. It did remind me in the first novel, Arya has a dream of King's Landing where the walls are full of blood and it kind of starts bubbling out of the walls. And I kind of thought, oh, this is kind of cool. It kind of reminds me of that dream Arya had. But then I kind of got the sense that this is all about sort of the Targaryen lineage.
That's what I kind of figured, right? And I thought it was going to
different channels.
And if that's
the case, I don't think that changes at all. I think the lineage stays the same. I don't think we're going to see the title sequence change.
You sure? Because there's going to be some Hightower a tributary at some point.
Maybe. I think this entire first season will stay the same. I mean, I could be wrong, but I think it's going to be... That's my guess. It's going to be the same the whole season.
Yeah, this will be a point of contention between Heather and I because she's traditionally a skip intro person, and I am famously I will listen to the entire Three's Company theme song regardless of how many times I've seen the episodes.
Well, and I feel like with the old title sequence, I would watch because I was kind of curious to see, especially when it was starting to. Latter seasons started to change. Right. If it's just going to be this, I'll skip it every time.
I think you should. I'm going to say stay tuned.
All right, I'll watch it just because maybe, of this
maybe not this season.
I'll keep my eyes on it.
Maybe not this season, but I mean, you don't want to be the one to be like, oh, what? It switched? When did it switch?
Okay, let's get you on the record. My favorite is... Episode 3, Cheek Speak Over Under.
Oh, we're due.
So just to remind people the rules. The amount of people with actual dialogue in the show that reveal a cheek or two. And then, of course, Steve is going to choose an over-under here.
Yeah, I'm going to go even higher. I'm setting up 5. I think we're due for something.
So you're saying 2 full moons and a side cheek.
Yep. Yep.
All right, that would give you five. So five were over.
Right.
And you got it. All right. I think you're right. I think we're probably due. So I think I'm going to take the over with you.
Okay.
And we'll see how we do. So far I'm one up.
Yep. You are the cheek master. The maester of cheeks. Little crack. All right. If you will.
Little crack.
So how do you rate this episode?
Oh, we didn't do that. I'm so glad you reminded me. I'm going to say Danny plus one.
Okay.
What do you think?
I'm going Danny plus three.
Oh, you're in Dinklage range.
I know.
You liked this one a lot.
Oh, I liked it a lot. And I think maybe it is the, like I said, I feel like I'm watching Game of Thrones again. So sure. It might have been more of that. The Rhaenys back and forth, I thought was excellent, and I was like, this is gonna be to me the best back and forth of the episode, and then the Daemon, egg toss, that whole I was like wow, that's really really good, and even though I felt like they didn't need to do that slow pan at the end with Corlys, like I'm like, well, who, like there's not enough characters for me to go like, oh, I wonder who he's talking to. Who could it be? but I think that was a really good way to
reiterate that walk through the garden with the king Lena. I just thought that got me feeling all kinds of gross. And yep. All right, I think you talked me up. I think I'm going to go Danny plus two. You talked me up a rank here.
No, I think it was a really good episode. Yeah. And I know that there are reviews from people that are already six episodes in, right? Like a lot of these, the bigger.
Yeah, a few of our podcast buddies got screeners, right?
And there's different... one of the things I keep hearing is I kind of miss the amount of characters. Like, it just feels like it's too incestuous in terms of the intro. And I'm kind of okay with that.
I'm curious. I think I agree with the critics on this one. I feel like I need to be introduced to some family that's away from King's Landing. Or some commoner that lives in the city, or someone that can bring a little bit of levity.
Mm.
When we did our rewatch of Game of Thrones, we talked about this like being like in the desert, and you need that, just that touch of cool water, just that drop of cool water. And I feel like we've gotten zero. First two.
I think I'll need it, but I think setting this new story up is I'm willing to be patient. I will need some of that later, but this is so intricate so far in terms of the how the political intrigue goes, and because it is so close, it feels even more sinister. But yeah, I definitely could see the need for a little more levity. And I know that we're going to do a time jump at some points, which also takes some of the childlike qualities out of Alicent. And
I think so. And I will be honest, I've really enjoyed young Alicent, and not young Alicent. I've really enjoyed young Rhaenyra.
Yeah, I agree.
And so when they do level her up to the next actress, I think I'm going to miss this actress. I think she's killing it.
I agree. I had that same thought, and not just because her friend broke a glass next to us at the premiere.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of Apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off badass season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints. Except, it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of bald movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim. Order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar. Then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R.R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, if very special isn't your speed, we've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd.
Medieval historian Ian McGinnis at the University of Highlands answers a listener question about paramours and affairs in the ancient world. If you have a question for Double Dragon, you can send that to book@baldmove.com. All right, this is a question from Jenny. In both Game of Thrones and House of the Dragon, we meet important men who are openly promiscuous, or at least they bring their paramours with them to important places. Presumably, these men are not concerned with public knowledge about their activities beyond the institution of marriage. In medieval Europe, would this have been taboo or had an adverse political consequence?
Yeah, I think, I mean, obviously the church frowns upon such things, particularly if the man in question was married. But yes, noblemen and kings did often have mistresses and as a result had quite a lot of potentially of illegitimate children. I mean, you get examples of men who had mistresses before they were married. They like to keep their options open in case a particularly choice bride-to-be came along who might gain them lands and things. So they would often have a woman who they had children with and who they might end up marrying further down the line. And those children would have to be retroactively
legitimized.
Sorry, yes, that's the word I was looking for.
Yeah.
But because yes, they've been born out of wedlock. So that kind of thinking does come into it. I think also that these men often did also look after their illegitimate offspring. I mean, that I think comes through in Game of Thrones quite a lot, that even if they're not treated the same, they're not a part of the succession, and that would be the same in medieval Europe on the whole. They are at least catered for, they're looked after, they're given lands and titles and money, and they are also useful in terms of marriage alliances. You know, if you marry the illegitimate daughter of the king, for example, that's still a leg up. The fact that she's an illegitimate daughter doesn't really matter. You're still related by blood to the crown. And that means,
and you might be something. Doing the king a favor, you know.
Yes, absolutely. Although I think, you know, the illegitimate children could be married off to other kings, prominent nobles. That they were still a catch. That there wasn't disfavor attached to that. And I think that's maybe something that the Game of Thrones, it spins the bastardy angle as a negative and as a defining feature. Obviously, if you're from the lower classes and you're illegitimate, then yes, that might have been the case. But noble bastards and royal ones actually still had some currency.
I think so that's valuable. a good question. I think that in Martin's universe, it might be more influenced by Shakespeare's bastards than historical bastards. You know, in Shakespeare, it's very much, you know, the bastard represents, especially if it's sort of a male bastard who might create complications for the true-born eldest son or something like that. That kind of guy is suspicious. Like, you have to be a little bit suspicious of that sort of fellow, because he might edge his way into political power and make problems with the family.
Yeah, although I kind of struggle to think of too many examples where that was the case. I think quite a lot of the examples you have are of illegitimate sons, for example, who are quite loyal to their fathers and who are useful military commanders. I suppose the problem then is when their fathers die and then their legitimate offspring that succeed, if that causes problems between half brothers.
So what about, I'm just thinking specifically in terms of like Daemon Targaryen, who has a wife who he just doesn't like, and he decides that he's going to take a paramour and like just parade her around, like just take her wherever he goes because he gets along with her. I'm just wondering, is that more fantasy than reality? It seems like that. It seems a little bit. It seems a little bit unrealistic that would be an option for someone who is of high political standing as someone like that.
I mean, it may be taking it slightly further, but not necessarily as much as you might think. I think, you know, there were several and many open secrets about royal or noble mistresses, and the fact they're open secrets means that they are largely accepted. I think where mistresses become problematic, is twofold. One is if they start to increase their own power or their family's power as a result of being the mistress of the king or the lord, then that becomes a problem for other nobles. And you get the case of that in England. Alice Perrers is the famous mistress of Edward III in his latter years, and she falls foul of the English establishment because she makes out quite as much as she does, and is seen as being dangerous. The same is true in Scotland. David II, his mistress Catherine Mortimer, is actually assassinated by the Scottish nobility because they feel that she is becoming too powerful, or her family potentially is becoming too powerful. It's intruding on their interests, and that's when it becomes a danger. I think if you're there and you just happen, but you're not out for yourself necessarily, if you're not expanding the interests of your family, then you're less of a threat.